You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
No need to adjust your dial. You're in the right place. This is WNYC. It's The Leonard Lopate Show. You can stay in your seats. I'm Dan Pashman, host of the Sporkful podcast here at WNYC, in for Leonard today. And it's my second day in a row hosting, so I thought maybe make some changes here. Maybe a new theme song for the show. You know, a lot of heads bobbing in the control room. I'm kidding. These, of course, are the dulcet tones of Metallica, known well to WNYC listeners. And we're playing it because it relates to our first guest. In his new book, John Powell writes, "I can almost guarantee that you won't be able to remember the first time music had an emotional effect on you. For instance, maybe the emotional effect you just had when you heard this song and you thought something was wrong with your radio. But John Powell says it has that emotional effect, and the first emotional effect that music had on you probably happened before you were born. Our connection to music is emotional, physical, intellectual. It's deep. And there's a lot of science behind why. That's the topic of Why You Love Music, From Mozart to Metallica, The Emotional Power of Beautiful Sounds, a new book by John Powell from Little Brown and Company. And John joins us now by phone. Hi, John.
Oh, hi, Dan. Thanks for having me on the show.
Welcome. Were you rocking out there in Nottingham, England, while you were listening?
It was a bit of a surprise, but it was great.
So researchers have identified several different personality traits and the kind of music that might be associated with each one. Can you walk me through those different personality traits and the corresponding music?
Yeah, sure. Psychologists in about the 1990s decided that there was about five personality traits that you could measure accurately. And these are your culture or intellect, your conscientiousness, your extroversion, your agreeableness, and whether or not you're neurotic. And when they'd done that, the musical psychologists actually gathered together various genres of music and matched some of the genres with some of the characteristics. So, for example, they gathered together music into four basic genres. One is reflective and complex music, which is classical, jazz, folk, and blues. Then there's intense and rebellious music, which is rock, alternative, and heavy metal. Then you've got upbeat and conventional, which is pop, country, and western, soundtracks and religious. And then you've got energetic and rhythmic music, which is rap, soul, and electronic, and dance music, and so on. So I don't know whether you want me to go through the whole lot, but let's just choose intense and rebellious music. Fans of intense and rebellious music are rather intelligent, they're skilled with words, and they're usually good at sports. On the other hand, people who are into reflective and complex music, like jazz and classical, are also good with words and intelligent, but they're poor at sports, and they're often politically liberal. So you can actually tell something about someone's personality from their 10 favorite songs.
Huh. What about the other two? I want to hear all of them. What about the other two categories?
Upbeat and conventional music, that's the pop, country, and western soundtracks and religious music. They are extroverts, they're agreeable, and they're conscientious. And they're good at sports and often politically conservative. And then you've got the party animals who are interested in energetic and rhythmic music, rap, soul, and electronic. And they tend to, they're very extrovert and agreeable, and they're often politically liberal.
And is there an age, later on, I don't want to get too much into it now, but is there an age component to those different musical tastes too?
Not really, no. There are lots of people who like, complicated music that are young and old, and there are lots of people who like upbeat and conventional music, you know, pop music and so on. That can go on through your life. There is a tendency in people to start appreciating more complicated music as they get older. And that's linked to that. I don't know whether you've ever had that effect of loving a pop song that you hear on the radio for about 2 or 3 weeks, and then suddenly you go off it and you can't stand it anymore.
Right.
It certainly happened to me. And what's happening there is we have a sort of Goldilocks attitude to the complexity of music. We don't like it too complicated. We don't like it too uncomplicated, which is it. We find it dull if it's too boring, and too difficult if it's complicated. So what happens is, as we get older, the bit we like best, you know, our optimum complexity actually gets more and more complicated. So when we were younger, we might like punk and heavy metal. And then as you get towards the age of 30, 40, you start finding that you know so much about punk or heavy metal or whatever you've chosen when you were younger, that you no longer find it stimulating. So you start moving towards jazz or classical.
Right, right. I want to talk more in a minute about how our tastes in music change as we age, but I want to just sort of make sure that we sort of finish up on the different personality types, because I'm so interested in that.
Mm-hmm.
So you're, in addition to being a scientist, you're also a musician and a composer yourself.
That's right, yeah.
Do you, when you're sitting down to write music, do you mm-hmm. use this research as you think about the kind of music that you want to create and the type of people that it might connect with?
Not really, no. I basically, like most composers, I just write what comes to me. And a lot of it comes to you when you're just fiddling around on your instrument. Sometimes you get some inspiration, but a lot of it is to do with taking some idea you've got, some small idea, and working it up into a more complicated, longer-lasting piece.
And so as a person who is very into music, I'm sure you have friends who are into music, you talk about music with your friends.
Yeah.
Do you find that your friends have... So if there's a connection between musical taste and personality, and there's a connection between the types of people that you like to be friends with, like, what does that say about the musical taste of your friends?
Well, whether it causes your friends to be like that, or whether their music taste is something they picked up when they're younger, is a rather difficult question. When we're all in our early to mid-teens, we're usually in a friend group, and we want to be respected and liked by that friend group, obviously. And then somebody in the group will start introducing some sort of music. And between the lot of you, the young teenagers, you'll come across a genre that you really like. In fact, you'll probably come across a band you like. And the band might actually drift from genre to genre, from track to track on an album. But you still link into that band. It's very important to be cool. And cool isn't something we should all sort of dismiss as being a silly teenage thing. I want to be cool and you want to be cool, because cool is basically a shorthand for how respected and liked you are by your peer group. So it's important when you're a young teenager that you have your own little band, and it can be a big disappointment if that band becomes mainstream, because part of being cool is that everybody else has to be uncool. As we get older, of course, we get a bit more realistic about it, and we realize that it's not an exclusive thing. We just happen to like this genre of music. So when we're younger, we latch onto a genre of music, and particularly onto a few bands, and we retain the love of that music all the way through our life. We do bond very heavily with the music we like between about 16 and 26.
And does that have something to do with our brains? I understand the issue of peer pressure and wanting to fit in, but does that also... have something to do with what our brains are like at that age?
It is. Basically, in the late teenage years, you have to decide what sort of person you're going to be. It wasn't a problem a couple of hundred years ago. If you were born a couple of hundred years ago and your family were farmers or sailors or fishermen or whatever, then your identity was basically mapped out for you. There wasn't a problem working out what you were going to be. But nowadays, there are so many choices that... in the teenage years, you know, you hang out with certain friends and you say, well, this is the sort of person I'm going to be. You don't do it consciously. It sort of sinks into you. And a part of that is the music you listen to.
Right. But are our brains also more malleable?
Yeah. I don't know. Our personalities are more malleable. I mean, the brain's a physical entity, so it's difficult to know how that's changing very much at that age. But you're using it differently. You're approaching life differently. You're actually thinking about yourself as an individual for the first time. You know, up to the age of about 12, you're a child, and everything is fed to you. The world is fed to you via your parents and teachers. But after that, you start thinking about yourself much more as an individual, and you start making choices. Some psychologists have shown that, you know, between the age of about 14 and 20, you make loads of choices about things you're going to stick with for the rest of your life. Including the sort of books you're going to read, the sort of films you're going to watch, the sort of music you're going to listen to, and even the sort of toothpaste you're going to use. So you invent yourself during those late teenage years.
So let's play a quick little game here, John.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to name an artist or two, and I want you to give me the sort of the workup on the person's personality and also their age. Okay.
Live on radio.
That's right. That's right.
You don't have much, do you? Okay.
I think you'll be okay. I'm not going to be too hard on you, I promise.
I hope I will have heard of the artist, but carry on.
All right. Billy Joel and Elton John.
Yeah. Well, Billy Joel and Elton John are definitely upbeat and conventional music. Basically, there are no musical surprises in what they do. I mean, I like both of them, actually. They're very tuneful. They concentrate on tunes and very harmonious chords and so on. So in the list I've just given you, they would certainly be in the middle of the upbeat and conventional. So if you are very keen on that sort of music, you will be an agreeable extrovert who's conscientious and good at sports and often politically conservative. I mean, obviously, what I'm saying here is an incredible generalization. You know, there will be a wide range of things you could be, but you'll find that maybe half the people involved would fall into those categories.
Okay. What about Taylor Swift and Kanye West?
Well, I'm a great admirer of Taylor Swift. The other musician I'm not that familiar with. But Taylor Swift, I think, would be... She'd be halfway between pop and the more complicated stuff. So you're getting nuances here of, you know, somebody, this is halfway between reflective and complex and upbeat and conventional. So you'd find that some of the characteristics were also leaking from one to the other.
I see. Okay, one more, Mozart and Beethoven.
Mozart and Beethoven, obviously classical, rather more complicated than most of the other stuff you've mentioned, because, well, basically there's a lot of pragmatic reasons why classical music has to be more difficult, because the pieces last longer. And so you can't keep on being jolly and tuneful for the whole thing. You've got to bring some sort of darkness into it occasionally. And also the composer has to make those tunes... I mean, Mozart won't put much more of a tune into the first movement of a symphony than Taylor Swift will do into a single song. But Mozart or Beethoven have to keep it going for longer. Even something as simple as Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, that da-da-da-da... He has to use that four notes and get through about 6 minutes or 7 minutes. So you've got to use it a lot more cunningly and in lots of various ways. So they generate a more complicated approach to the basic tunes they use.
And I find, in my experience, the songs that I fall in love with the very first time I hear them, I don't end up loving for a long time.
No, that's something I mentioned earlier. I didn't actually finish what I was saying about it.
Oh, sorry, go on.
If you like. Yeah. Basically, going back to this thing about we like music to be at a certain level of complication. We all have our individual ranges, below which it's too boring and above which it's too complicated. And if you really like something the first time you hear it, it falls into your I like this thing. But the first time you hear it, you don't know anything about it. You don't know which way the tune's going to go. You don't know which way the chords are going to go or the rhythm or anything else. So it has an extra layer of complexity on the music automatically because it's new to you. As you get more and more familiar with it, its complexity diminishes. And eventually, it might just fall below your this is too boring level. That's why occasionally you listen to a pop song and love it for about 2 or 3 weeks. But after 30 hearings, you think, this is just too boring for me. And you don't listen to it again.
And what are some of the things that would be different about a song that I might have to learn to love a little bit, but that I would end up loving for longer?
Well, this has happened to me on several occasions when I bought an album, in the days when people bought albums rather than make playlists. I'd buy the album for the charming track that I really liked the first time I heard it. And there'd be another track on the same side of the album, which was tricky, maybe a bit too jazzy for me, a bit too complicated. I would find as I listened to the album, listening to my charming track, that the charming track got more and more boring for me and fell below my this is too boring level perhaps. And the complicated track, which on first hearing I thought, this is a bit hard work, as I got used to it and got to know what's going to happen next and understood, just you know, subconsciously understand what the chords are doing, what the harmonies and the tunes are doing, that would come into my acceptable levels. And there was an album called Elegy by the Nice where this happened specifically. I loved the charming track on one side and didn't like the jazz track. And they swapped sides in my mind eventually. And I really loved the jazz track now because that had become simpler for me because I now knew more about it. And the charming track I liked at first fell below my acceptable level.
Right. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, I want to talk more about how our tastes in music change as we age and also how that might affect musicians themselves and the music that they make. And as we go out to break now, we're going to listen to Elton John's song from 1974, The Bitch Is Back. When we come back, we're going to hear what Elton John sounded like in 1991. I'm speaking with John Powell about the way music affects our brains. He's a musician and scientist, and his book is called Why You Love Music, From Mozart to Metallica, The Emotional Power of Beautiful Sounds. It's published by Little Brown & Company. We'll hear more from him after a break. Hope you have your lighters out. This is Elton John's Circle of Life from 1991 when he was 44. Going to break, we heard The Bitch Is Back from 1974 when he was 27. So we heard a song with sort of a lot of edge, a lot of attitude that Elton John wrote when he was 27. And this one, Circle of Life, he was 44. It's a little bit schmaltzier. I gotta say, I'm speaking with John Powell, author of Why You Love Music, From Mozart to Metallica, The Emotional Power of Beautiful Sounds, who joins us by phone from England. And John, what happened to Elton John between the time he was 27 and the time he was 44?
Well, you're quite right in saying the second piece of music is schmaltzier. But it's also more complicated as a piece of music.
Okay.
So what he's done, because the first song was very straightforward, very straightforward three-chord bash with a simple tune repeating itself over and over again. It's a good track, obviously, but the sort of thing you might want to drive down the freeway to. But it's a very simple song indeed. But the second track is much more complicated, and it has a lot more darkness to it as well. So he's bringing in changes in mood during the song and building up an emotional expectations and then releasing those expectations. That's the sort of thing composers, which he is a composer, composers do during the course of a lifetime. They tend to get more complicated. This is one of the benefits of being a composer, actually, if it's your hobby, or even if it's your job. Composers tend to get better. They tend to get more skilled as they get older. So you'll find that a lot of classical people who like classical music concentrate on the latter few years of any composer's life. If you listen to Mozart, you get the same sort of thing. Very simple, straightforward tunes at the beginning of his life. Much more complicated stuff by the time he's in his final years, even though he died very young.
But do they also tend to get schmaltzier as they get older?
No. The schmaltz is just incidental in that case.
Okay.
But the intended emotions could be anything at all. You could go for excited dancing or whatever, but whatever they want to produce, they'll use more skill with it. It's a bit like a novelist who gets better at their job, and they get so good in the end that you can't actually spot what's going to happen in their later stuff.
Right.
It's much more difficult to spot what's going to happen to the plot. That's why they refer to a lot of early novels and early classical music and early pop music as juvenilia, because it's young stuff. It's not that polished. It's very straightforward, and they haven't got the skills together yet.
But say what you will about the earlier Elton John clip we heard, that song has an edge to it.
Yeah.
It has an anger to it that you don't hear in the later music. And I do feel, speaking for myself, my own taste in music as I've gotten a little bit older,
yeah,
I find myself gravitating more towards Circle of Life and less to The Bitch Is Back. So what's happening to me?
Well, as we get older, we all slow down a bit, and we all get a bit more reasonable and less demanding, hopefully.
Oh, are we recording this? Can I play this for my wife later?
Well, I'll also tell my girlfriend that.
Okay, great.
Okay, but I'm getting more reasonable now.
Right.
No, I mean, you get less less unreasonably demanding and less potentially violent about your demands and your wishes and less cross about things, because you realize that life's a lot more complicated than you thought when you were 18. And that it's important to make, you know, compromises all the time. So, yes, if you want to call that schmaltz, you can, but really, as far as musicians and composers are concerned, they will be hunting to give you, I mean, a composer, whether it's a folk singer or a jazz pianist or someone in the classical field, they will be trying to bring emotions out in you, and they may go for youthful aggression, and they may go for youthful love, or they may go for the sort of calm effect, the schmaltzy effect.
Mm-hmm. We had a question from Ron from East Brunswick. He's curious to know if musicians and composers' music tends to get more complicated as they get older because they're just better at proficiency in instruments, or is it something developmental?
Well, composers don't need to be able to play the instrument they're writing for, but they do get better skilled as they get older, and so they get more demanding in that way. As they get more experienced, and also they might start dealing with better musicians if their experience is going up. And so you might find that sort of Benny Goodman stuff was rather more simple when he was younger, but when he could afford a better band, he made it more complicated because he had better musicians working for him.
Right, so he had better resources. I'm speaking with John Powell, author of Why You Love Music, From Mozart to Metallica, The Emotional Power of Beautiful Sounds from Little Brown and Company. And so, John, I mean, I know the sort of the overarching question and topic of your book is what is it about music that connects with us so deeply? Can you give us the sort of the answer to that big question?
If you've got about 3 hours, yes. Now, as an author, I should say, go and buy the book. But no, there is actually, I can give you a clue as to why music is so deeply embedded in us. And basically, if you imagine you have a pharmacy inside you, which is dispensing chemicals to deal with various situations. For example, if a dog comes up barking at you and frightens you, then you'll get adrenaline into your system, which will help you to either run away from the dog or fight it. And these chemicals are in our system all the time, and there's like a dispensary, a pharmacy, inside you, and your brain decides what's going to be handed out for the moment. Well, music has the keys to the pharmacy. You can actually trigger various chemical releases into your bloodstream by music, and you can cut down things that are in your system. For example, music can be treated, if you're an insomniac, it can actually, within about 4 weeks of listening to 45 minutes of classical music before you go to sleep, you can, in the case of young people, 30 out of 35 people, that's 90%, stopped being insomniac. In the case of people over about 60, 70, half of them stopped being insomniac. That's because the reason why you can't go to sleep is because you've got too much of a chemical called noradrenaline in your system. You can't. Noradrenaline is a measure of how vigilant you feel. You know, and if you're vigilant, you can't go to sleep. So your dispensary, your pharmacy, is handing out noradrenaline when you don't want it to. But music has the keys to the pharmacy, so it can go and lock that particular drug up, and you don't get it, and so therefore you start sleeping properly.
So you can you could prescribe different types of music for different situations.
Yes. You can prescribe different sorts of music, give different chemical effects to your, you can actually test the chemistry of your blood and see it change with different sorts of music, which is pretty remarkable.
It is remarkable.
Yeah.
I feel like I want to have listeners call in and tell me how they're feeling right now, and you could prescribe different types of music to each of them.
Well, I'll tell you what, if you play them that piece of music you open this part of the show to the Metallica, they'll certainly get a shot of adrenaline. And so if any of them are driving on the freeway and they're getting a bit bored, they'll suddenly wake up.
I get it. I'm guessing that Metallica, though, not the best prescription for insomnia.
No, in that case, you're better off with soothing classical music like Mahler's Adagietto or something like that. But
right.
it really does work, and it's a genuine cure. It's not just a sort of patch over it. You can actually alter your body chemistry just with music.
So let's say it's middle of the afternoon. I've been sitting at a desk in front of my computer all day doing work.
Mm-hmm.
And I decide to go out for a walk. I'm working from home that day. I decide to go out for a walk around the block, stretch my legs. I'm feeling a little groggy, a little just sort of flat, burnt out.
Yeah.
I'm looking to get a little pep in my step. What kind of music do I need?
First of all, it's got to be a piece of music you like, because pieces of music you like will give you a serotonin hit. It's a pleasure chemical, which we get if you eat something. Eating is good for you, so that if you eat a sandwich, you will also get some serotonin into your system, which will give you a pleasure response, which means that you'll go back and eat again eventually. because that's what your body is designed to teach you to do things that are good for you. So first of all, pick a piece of music you like. And of course, if you are feeling dopey, you want some dopamine, which gives you focus. You want some adrenaline, which gives you energy. And so you might go for Chaka Khan or something. Ain't nobody.
Okay. All right, nice. All right. Yeah. Now, what if I'm feeling just kind of a little down, a little melancholy, and I don't really want to be cheered up? I'm kind of in a mood to wallow.
Right. Well, I mean, it's a peculiar side effect of music. And they haven't actually identified exactly why we put on sad music to amplify our sad mood. The best guess so far is that we put it on so that we can examine sadness without actually being sad during it. We quite often play sad music when we're not feeling sad. So Leonard Cohen or something like that. And you can wallow. You can put on, the Smiths or Leonard Cohen, or lots of classical music is very sort of slow and relaxing. It's a way of relaxing as well. So you can get that bittersweet unhappiness. You generally don't go for genuine unhappiness, though, because it's not something to go for anyway. And music is generally pleasant, and it will generally cheer you up, even if it's sad music.
Right. Every once in a while, John, I'll encounter someone who says, I just don't really like music. I'm just not into music. What's going on there?
Well, there are a whole bunch of people. There's about 2% of people who can't distinguish notes from each other. They have a lot of difficulty with it. We use the semitone in Western music as being the biggest step involved, and that's quite common for human beings. The semitone is quite a big step. It's a distance distance between two notes on a piano. We can tell whether if you play two notes semitone apart, you can tell whether the second one is up or down from the first one. But some people who are amusic, they can't tell. The notes are too close together for them, and they simply can't tell whether the second note's higher than the first one. And that makes it very difficult for them to understand or see music. If the jumps in the tune are very small, they can't tell whether it's jumped at all. And if they're very big tunes, jumps like Somewhere Over the Rainbow, da-dee, they can tell it's gone up, but they can't tell how far it's gone up. So basically they're lost. They're just flying blind. It's just nonsense as far as they're concerned.
Right.
That's about 2% of people, which is very unfortunate for them, but they are actually tone deaf.
That is unfortunate. And one more question for you. In this age of digital music, we all walk around with entire music libraries in our pockets, many of us. And it's becoming, because it's easier to buy individual songs and make playlists, people listen to whole albums from beginning to end less frequently than they used to.
Yeah.
How has this affected the way that we experience music?
Well, there's one excellent outcome from this, and there's one that's not so great. The excellent one is that the young people nowadays, and it's also spreading to us older people, are making playlists where they have a very wide taste. You'll get African drumming, followed by Sinatra, followed by some jazz piano, and so on, all on the same playlist. So everyone's taste is widening, which I think is excellent. The disappointing part of it, which I think is not as important as a good bit, is that the original intention of the songwriter or the composer has been a little bit lost because they wrote the whole album to be experienced as one thing. And someone like Joni Mitchell, say, might spend a couple of days deciding whether this track goes before that track or after the next track. And there's a lot of thought gone into it. People will go on about things like Mozart rotating in his grave, but in fact, a lot of the stuff that the big classical composers were doing is trying to keep the audience interested for half an hour or 40 minutes. So you just change mood. So your second movement of a symphony will be completely different from the first and may not be connected to it at all. It's just to have a jolly first movement and a slow second movement or whatever it happens to be. So it's not, you shouldn't be too precious about playing classical music tracks in the wrong order.
Right.
Because in some cases, the composer didn't actually care that much. And in lots of rock albums, the same thing applies, where they don't really care which way you listen to it. But in some cases, there was a delicate balance of this one should follow that one. And that is being lost.
Right.
But I think that's outweighed by the brilliant thing of people listening to so much different music.
Okay, well, I've been speaking with scientist and musician John Powell. His book is Why You Love Music, From Mozart to Metallica, The Emotional Power of Beautiful Sounds. It's published by Little Brown and Company. John, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks very much. Thank you.